I want people to understand South Asian art as bigger than a single gallery or a single artist, but as a larger cultural movement. I want people to be encountering art in all parts of their lives, and I'm constantly thinking about new ways to go about that. Because I was very aware, as someone launching a South Asia-focused gallery, that that was the cultural dynamic that had undergirded the way that most people in the West were thinking about art from the region. And so taking that on directly and inviting artists to work with that theme was a really important grounds for setting the ethos of the gallery and the types of critical questions we wanted to take on with the work we were doing.
My guest today is Rajiv Menon, a gallerist and curator who is carving out a distinctive space in the contemporary art world. Based in Los Angeles, Rajiv holds a PhD from NYU, where he studied global media and visual culture, and he's also a passionate collector of South Asian art. He founded Rajiv Menon Contemporary with a clear mission to bring artists from South Asia and its diaspora to a wider audience and to cultivate a new generation of art collectors within these communities. His exhibitions have tackled fascinating themes from the exuberant and sometimes overwhelming world of the Indian wedding through Viraj Khanna's intricate textile art in its current exhibition, Why Did I Say Yes?, to a deep dive into the creativity of Kerala in Three Steps of Land, and a compelling look at how artists transform nostalgia into an aesthetic movement in The Past is a Country. His work resonates far beyond the gallery walls, aiming to shift our collective culture. He's also recently been honored by the City of Los Angeles for his contributions to the arts. Rajiv Menon, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to chat.
And talk about bringing exhibitions beyond the gallery walls. I believe you're preparing, if we can talk a little bit about that, you're bringing your first Indian-American exhibition to India, to the Jaipur Palace. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we will be the first individual gallery to curate at the Jaipur Center for Art, which is a new platform built out of the City Palace in Jaipur. It's a really significant opportunity, not only because it's this major platform in the City Palace that's able to really showcase Indian art for a global audience, but it's also an opportunity to bridge conversations between the diaspora and the homeland. And that was very much the spirit I went into this exhibition with. The exhibition is entitled Non-Residency, which is all about the aesthetics of diaspora. An Indian who lives abroad is called a non-resident Indian, or NRI. And I wanted to think about that category of non-residency, not just as a social one, but as an aesthetic one, and think about how that experience of migration, immigration, displacement, exile feels through artwork. What's the emotional sort of texture of those types of experiences? And how are artists sort of encountering the homeland from the position of the diaspora? And so it all kind of centers around the idea of non-residency as an experience of the uncanny, and how the experience between the homeland and the diaspora is often one of the distortion of familiarity, of a sense of doubling, all things that feel very strongly aligned with the uncanny. I also want to use the exhibition as an opportunity to announce a really significant cohort of artists who are working through singular practices, but also in concert to create a larger movement. And I'm calling that the non-resident school. I wanted to announce that there is this body of work and this group of artists that is working to shift the culture in a very meaningful way and present them in that codified way for the first time through this incredible platform.
Yeah, that's so interesting, that term non-resident, because I think about the, it'd be like living between two worlds, or sometimes the departed or the those in exile or the immigrant is kind of dealing with ghosts. Like they kind of get lore. You know this. I know this as a second generation, but not of South Asian, but of Asian, East Asian origin, born in America, but though I'm now in Europe. And you're dealing with the ghosts of people you've never met in a way. And if you're raised by a few different generations, because if you have the grandparents and the parents, then they've preserved their memories and it kind of lives on in you, but you'd never get the full story. So it's very interesting kind of perspective to unpack and understand.
Absolutely. I think so much about how when you grow up abroad, away from India or whatever the country of origin is, you're having to sort of construct identity through the materials you have and through those residues of what's been left behind. And it makes complete sense to me that for those in the motherland, in this case in India, when they see that culture, they feel that it's odd and distorted and different than what they're used to. By nature, it's going to be. And so that felt like a really exciting grounds to investigate through art, to actually look at that perceived gulf between the motherland and the diaspora and actually see it not as a barrier, but as a rich place of cultural creation. And I wanted to turn our position of loss. I love the way that you describe the culture as ghosts. So much of our experience growing up in the West is defined by the loss of that source of origin. And to take that experience of loss and turn it into something very fertile and productive and challenging felt like a really exciting opportunity. And I think the artists that I'm getting to exhibit absolutely exemplify that dynamic.
Yeah, and it's also interesting about the children of immigrants or the grandchildren of immigrants, because it's often a multi-generational family. At the one point, they are the teachers and of their parent. They're the cultural translators in some ways. I mean, they're being, you know, their parents are taking care of them, but in other ways, they can only explain, you know, as natively born into the American culture, where whatever country that they may have immigrated to, there are things that their parents or grandparents will never really understand in the same way. So it's a kind of interesting, like, cultural translator, and then how that, how the artists who grew up with these experiences then go on to become kind of cultural translators in their artistic career.
Translation is exactly the language I use to think, not only about the artist's work, but about my own work. I think even though we're working within visual mediums, I feel like I'm constantly having to translate the context in which the artists are creating. I feel like the artists themselves are translating deep emotional and psychological experiences into visual and aesthetic ones. And now in the show between the diaspora and the homeland, I feel like I'm translating between those two spaces and helping India understand diasporic perspectives better as well, but also allowing diasporic artists to understand the rich cultural context of contemporary India. I think one of the biggest critiques that diasporic creatives receive is that they're responding to a version of India that exists within the past. And that is a very valid criticism. I think that in my lifetime, I've seen the critique of the diaspora within India shift from this idea that we're overly westernized and that we've lost touch with India to almost the opposite, that we've become too fixated on an India of the past and that we're old-fashioned and out of touch with Indian modernity. And I wanted to understand how there's always this present critique of the diaspora within the homeland. And no matter what position is being taken, it always places the diaspora into a position of subordination or derivation in relation to the motherland. I wanted to intervene with that and show that actually diasporic work is very much thinking in the present tense. And the same kind of emotional experiences that might lead to someone being more old-fashioned or backwards-facing can also be the grounds for tremendous innovation. And I think the artists within this exhibition really are just that. They're taking their position within the diaspora and using it as a grounds to create forms of being, to create forms of aesthetics that are fully new and wholly original.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I don't want to say it can become fossilized, but it becomes the culture that it gets passed on to you can be static in that moment of time that your parents or grandparents came. You know, they have a version of, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, the first or second generation's fault, but that's just how the conversation is. And they probably also feel, I know that you were, you know, as you were growing up, we're going back and forth. I mean, being raised in America in Houston, but going back and forth to India, so you would get a contemporary experience of it, but you still, you know, it's not totally static, but it's natural that that would happen if, like, some immigrants don't go back, you know?
Completely. And I was born in 1988, so my early childhood in India, when we were going, was in the early 90s when the country was liberalizing. And all of a sudden, the India I was encountering through my lifetime was fundamentally different than the one my parents had seen because they grew up pre-liberalization. They left in the 70s. And so I was definitely cognizant of this massive change that was happening in India and the impossibility of treating it as a sort of static cultural space. And I think that's been kind of a mission of mine as someone who's regularly going back, especially with my peers in the diaspora, is to not think of India as this imagined source of cultural purity and authenticity in our past, but actually looking to it for our future. One of the things I found so inspiring as an Indian American creative when working in India was that it allowed me to take on these questions of what it meant to be an Indian person in a globalized world in a way that fundamentally centered our perspective. We didn't have to sort of think of ourselves as minoritized because we were back in India and able to have creative discussions that centered us. And that was so small, but revolutionary for the way that I wanted to present Indian work for a global stage. And I'm constantly thinking about how my exhibitions can challenge the way that folks in the diaspora are thinking about their own cultural positioning, because that sense of fossilization that you gesture towards is very present.
Yeah, of course. It's a thriving digital hub. I mean, so many things. I mean, and such, you know, leading economy, and, you know, it's diverse, the variety of experience that maybe wasn't the one that, you know, your parents or grandparents experienced. Okay, so one of going to some of your exhibitions that deal on this very subject, The Past is a Country, you know, really ask that question. I think about, it's not an Indian word, but I always think about that. Saudade, the Portuguese word, means a longing for something that does not and cannot exist. And so this exhibition, you know, examines nostalgia, you know, as an aesthetic movement. What does it really mean?
Yeah, that was a very special exhibition because it was my opportunity to really take on something that I had felt so deeply in my life, as well as showcase the way that nostalgia can be thought of in different ways. It doesn't necessarily have to be something that bogs us down and holds us to the past, but instead can be this creative spark that gives us a new framework to think about the future. And what I was interested in with the artists I was seeing, it was the translation of that feeling of memory and nostalgia from a sensory one into an aesthetic one. And I think all of them were grappling with this question. What does memory feel like? What does it actually look like? What does that experience of having a memory in your head translate to through artistic practice? And from there, they were able to create these very innovative ways of making. And I think techniques of mark making to storytell and so much that felt fundamentally fresh and exciting while rooted in contending with the past. And I think the goal of that show was to show that we can grapple with our sense of loss and the past while also steadfastly working towards the future and innovation. And that was a combination of diasporic artists and artists based in South Asia. And I think each artist brought something really special to the group exhibition that created a whole different language for how we can think about it. And I wanted to think about nostalgia as a grounds for creation, ultimately, which I think came across really beautifully.
Yeah, and it also engaged with, you know, it's a complex, the history, the colonial legacies. I mean, so many things that are quite difficult to understand just on through the visual arts. I mean, it's a history that we're only really kind of grappling with now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, you know, not only thinking about the legacy of colonialism, but also the legacy of partition, the legacy of all these moments of upheaval within South Asian history, and then the history of immigration. Indians in America are a relatively new immigrant group. We've only been able to immigrate after 1965 in large numbers. And so I think our own kind of contending with that experience of loss and rupture that comes with that experience of immigrating was a big theme of that as well. But it was really exciting because I think we got to take on a swath of experiences and engagements with history in the past that really came together in beautiful concert.
Yeah, and also escaping that colonial gaze. I mean, what, you know, separating out from, I mean, what I feel is a shameful history of Britain in the region and around the world. I mean, America has its own, American seems to have taken the reins, you know, after British lost its empire. Now we have the, you know, we don't have to go into that, but it's because so often the arts coming from South Asia or other parts of Asia or, you know, different parts of the world have this exoticism put on it.
Mm-hmm. And that is a theme I have been so fixated on since launching. Our first ever pop-up exhibition was called Item Number, which is a reference to a type of song in Bollywood. But the theme of the show was really about exoticism and how artists, especially in the diaspora, challenge, reimagine, playfully reinterpret tropes of exoticism. Because I was very aware as someone launching a South Asia-focused gallery that that was the cultural dynamic that had undergirded the way that most people in the West were thinking about art from the region. And so taking that on directly and inviting artists to work with that theme was a really important grounds for setting the ethos of the gallery and the types of critical questions we wanted to take on with the work we were doing.
Yeah. And so what if, you know, I think that you've been working hard to get your artists into museum collections and really, you know, for this really that legacy building. And now we're, you know, you're a newish gallery, you know, entering the global art market, you know, what specific strategies are you using to not only promote emerging artists, but also build those kind of enduring relationships with museums and collectors to ensure that long-term support that's really, you know, important for the art ecosystem?
I want people to understand South Asian art as bigger than a single gallery or a single artist, but as a larger cultural movement. And I want museums, collectors, spaces all over culture to feel like they're participating in something big that's happening in the global landscape right now, which I truly believe is true of this moment for South Asian visual culture broadly. So it's very important for me to not only be in constant communication with museums, to bring in curators, to introduce them to new artists, which has been going really well. We've been able to place quite a few works in museums in our first year and a half, which is something I'm very proud of. But I also want to think about the way that South Asian art is entering the wider culture broadly. And so we've had a partnership with the restaurant Dishoom in London. They launched a new restaurant with a lodging space above it called Dishoom Permit Room and Dishoom Lodgings. And I curated a selection of prints for the lodgings where guests will stay and be immersed with South Asian art. That was a great example of the way that we wanted to take art above and beyond the gallery walls. I'm similarly thinking about how we can engage with the world of fashion. We're in Los Angeles, so it's very important for me to be in dialogue with the world of film and television, because these are the visual mediums through which South Asian work is largely entering the cultural mainstream. And so I think really being attuned to other nodal points within culture and how we can create not just one exciting gallery, but a larger movement that is shifting the culture from all directions is very much my philosophy. And I want people to be encountering art in all parts of their lives. And I'm constantly thinking about new ways to go about that.
Yes. And of course, you've worked in film and television for over 10 years. And of course, you're still in Los Angeles, so you must be looking at scripts and have a foothold in that even as you're working on your gallery now. So just tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate to have the very specific and odd combination of skills. Former academic, I did my PhD at NYU and went through very rigorous traditional humanistic training in terms of how to think about culture, how to think about literature, how to think about film, and also how to think about contemporary art. I am so grateful for having that kind of intense training, because I think it fundamentally shifted the way I saw the world, and it gave me just a critical framework to be able to take on the challenge of art in general. So I'm very grateful for having a very rigorous academic training through my PhD. I think I was able to just immerse myself in theory and in critical writing that gave me such an important framework for how to talk about culture and how to see culture. And then I went from that to almost the exact opposite, to where I was working in development and marketing and production for television. And all of a sudden, I had to learn how to communicate in a very accessible way. I had to learn how to speak to a wide audience. And I had to bolster a lot of the skills I developed in academia with a lot more practical skills for the world of entertainment and advertising and marketing. And I think those two skills together, splitting the difference between them, has been so helpful within the art world, because I'm not only able to speak curatorially about the nature of the work, but then I'm also able to translate it in an accessible way for a wide audience. And I think one of the points of pride of the gallery is that we really want to be a space of accessibility, not in terms of the artwork. I want to show challenging, interesting work, but in terms of connoisseurship. I want people to come in and feel comfortable asking questions and improving their own palette and feeling more comfortable in a gallery setting. And I hope that through that experience, they can just engage with art even more broadly. And I think art is for everyone. It is something that everyone should be able to access if they're able to engage with what they're looking at. And I'm very deliberate in being very present in the gallery. I will give walkthroughs to almost anyone who comes in and make them feel welcome and make them feel comfortable and make them feel fluent in the artwork itself. I think my own experience through my 20s, going to galleries, I often felt intimidated. I often didn't feel welcome. These were spaces where I didn't necessarily know people, and you're all of a sudden coming into worlds that feel extremely rarefied. And while wanting to preserve the preciousness and the importance and significance of the work, I also wanted to infuse the gallery with a sense of hospitality and approachability.
Yeah, that's something that I think that we could all learn more about. It seems like a great ground for preparing you, because you can't communicate in a very high-handed or academic way to people who are collectors or just want to appreciate the art. It's about emotions, ultimately. But it's also about learning and expanding your consciousness. But it's about engaging their feelings with a hook that you would have. That's a great experience to have that from the marketing end of film and television, where you have to hook people quickly. If you've lost them in the first 2 seconds or something, then they just move on. So I think that that's great to find that midway, because I feel like when I appreciate art, it's not that I always want to be learning something, but I think it's always great to have some kind of story behind it. And so it's not just the immediate, you need those layers. And so I think that that's great that you learn those different storytelling modes.
Absolutely. And I love the way you describe it as consciousness raising, because that ultimately is the goal of art. I want people to not only have an intellectual experience, but a spiritual experience. I want them to be moved really deeply and to understand their capacity to discover new forms of meaning. With that first step of the hook and getting them in and engaged, they might leave the gallery with a shifted understanding of the world. And if I can facilitate that, it is just an absolute honor and a privilege.
And I think that South Asians broadly, or Indians in particular, are great storytellers, and they're often drawing upon so many centuries of mythologies that are, you know, and it's living with the ghosts, it's living with all these traditions, but in a very everyday way that I don't fully understand, but this is what has been communicated to me, you know, in a way that maybe in the West that we've forgotten a lot of our mythologies, we don't think about it so much. And I think that I don't know how you are illuminating that in different exhibitions.
I am very interested in neo-mythology. I mean, for South Asian artists, it's impossible to stay away from mythology, because that is one of the biggest art historical and just visual reference where we're surrounded by. And so I love bringing in artists who are reimagining mythology, especially as a grounds for personal storytelling. One artist I love working with, who we'll have a solo with in the fall and who will also be in the Jaipur exhibition, is named Sahana Ramakrishnan. Sahana combines, you know, personal storytelling and personal writing, which she'll incorporate into the canvases, with mythological references from not only Hindu and Himalayan mythology, but also European mythological traditions. And through that blending and syncretism of all these different traditions of the macro and the micro, of the personal, of the grandiose, she finds this beautiful language not only to think about storytelling broadly, but also to think about herself. And I'm constantly on the lookout for mythological storytellers who are pushing boundaries and pushing that genre further in ways that I haven't seen.
Yes. And so, I mean, it must also be complex to bring, because it's a large region with so many different traditions. We just mentioned some of them. And of course, languages and the calligraphy and the, you know, so how do you, you're going between different, how do you prioritize, or how do you balance that? Because it's like, we don't necessarily think of it, but it's like creating a gallery that's called the Western Art Gallery. You know what I mean? It's like a lot of traditions.
Completely. And I took on that challenge almost immediately. I don't want to try and define South Asia through art through the gallery. Instead, I want to demonstrate the impossibility of defining South Asia through a single body of work, because it is infinite and so multivariate and heterogeneous. All these group shows just start to scratch the surface of the multiplicity of perspectives that exist within the region. And I'm constantly looking to show perspectives that I haven't before, and to demonstrate how many different cultures exist within the very broad umbrella of South Asia. I did an exhibition on Kerala last year, and we'll be doing a similar one kind of as an annual return to that theme. And I grew up with a family from Kerala in a wider milieu of the South Asian diaspora, where we were a linguistic minority comparatively to other folks who were Hindi, Gujarati, or Punjabi speaking, as the majority were. I quickly was attuned to the fact that Indian could mean very many different things. And so that mindset always sort of sunk in. And I want to stress, there is no stable notion of what South Asian art is. It's simply an umbrella for infinite types of perspectives. I hope as people come into the gallery, they leave with that perspective.
Yes, and how it's very intertwined. I mean, there's the arts of the everyday, or there's the high art or the fine art, but I know there's so many traditions within textiles or calligraphy. You know, how are you honoring that, those aspects of creativity in exhibitions?
Absolutely. I think it is so important for contemporary South Asian art to think about living heritage, because you have these craft traditions that are very much forms of contemporary art. They are made by living practitioners, and they're often dismissed as less than or low art, while being very rooted in lineages of making and really sharp perspectives about the culture. So I'm very interested in artists who bridge those gaps. Viraj Khanna is an artist who we work with quite a bit and who just launched this very exciting solo with the gallery. And his work is in collaboration with karigars, or traditional artisans who work in embroidery. And he was very much thinking about how contemporary art can also be a platform for showcasing India's living traditions. And I think I'm increasingly interested in practices that make those types of collaborative leaps, because I do think living traditions are a very important part of the contemporary art world and should be in dialogue. They shouldn't be eschewed in favor of more traditionally understood contemporary art. And that's something that is an ongoing conversation. Textile art is very important to me. We'll be showing another textile artist named Lakshmi Madhavan next month, and she's working with the Balrampuram weaving community in Kerala. It's one of the last communities that makes Kasava, which is a heritage fabric from Kerala. And she, again, wanted to think about how her own conceptual practice could be a means to highlight and preserve a craft form that is under threat of absolute disappearance. And so I'm very cognizant of the need to engage with craft traditions and to show that they belong within this dialogue.
Oh, yeah. I think we actually have an environmental channel as well. And so I think about the way, you know, the contemporary textile industry, which is not, you know, with all the dyes. I mean, this is another separate subject, but it's, you know, poisoning rivers and things like that. So yeah. I think it's good that we return and honor these older traditions that I think are kinder to the environment, to our rivers and our soil.
And I find that so many of the textile artists that I work with are very attuned to that question of sustainability and understanding that you can't really talk about the textile as a material without this immediate pressing concern of how it's affecting our natural world.
Exactly. And thinking also about that broader range of the traditional or the everyday arts, I mean, you also think about culinary arts or music. There are all these ways in, the classic gateways into a culture. Like before you get to know a culture, these are like ways that are immediate.
Absolutely. And those are, you know, kind of conversations we want to facilitate through the gallery. We're currently in the process of planning a very special culinary event with a chef here in LA. I'll hopefully have more details on that soon. And we're also bringing music into the gallery. In the past, we've worked with the artist Sid Sriram, who's someone I really admire and I think really captures the spirit of the gallery through his own musical practice. Hopefully we'll have some more to announce soon. So I do want to think about interdisciplinarity and how different mediums can be in dialogue through the gallery.
Yes, and there's, a spiritual dimension to all arts, but I think particularly so in South Asia. Do you have some exhibitions down the line that are focusing on this?
There are themes I want to explore. I think there's been a really beautiful resurgence of neo-tantric art and thinking about tantra as an artistic practice. And this is something that's very much on my radar and something I'd love to explore in a deeper way. I also am very moved by meditation as a practice. It's a very big part of my life. And it's something that I'm really interested in exploring in relation to art making and thinking about how not only the culture of meditation and yoga and all these different entry points for South Asian culture, the US, have shaped the cultural consciousness, but specifically how meditative practices find their way into art making. Definitely something top of mind and something to keep an eye out for in the next year or so.
And could you tell us, I mean, I know it's a bit tough to single out particular artworks or artists that have moved you or really made you think, but when you're approaching an artwork or an artist for the first time, what draws you in? And if you'd like to talk about particular works or broader exhibitions, that would be great too.
Yeah, I think of the magic moment happening at the intersection of intellect and spirit. I think when I am both deeply moved by a work of art, but also very intellectually stimulated, that's where I feel like something magic is happening. And I think the spiritual part of it can often be difficult to articulate, and the intellectual part can often be purely articulated, but often not felt. And when I'm able to blend those two experiences, I feel like that's the magic that art can create for me. There are a few really big moments I've had that have really spoken to that. Many of the last few years, coming in the pandemic, seeing Salman Thur's exhibition at the Whitney Museum was a real breakthrough for me. I think I was just not only struck by his engagement with art history, just the vibrant use of color, the mark making, but also the deep feeling of longing and alienation and connection that he was able to communicate through his canvases in that exhibition. It was really a life-changing event for me because I walked out with a different understanding of the world and how feeling could be expressed visually. I had a really similar experience with the Lucian Freud retrospective at the National Gallery in London, where I had seen many Lucian Freud works throughout my life in different museum collections, but to see such a sweeping retrospective and to really understand his genius and the power of his manipulation of oil, I think it felt changed. You know, like I felt like something within me had shifted from my experience of encountering one of the greats in that capacity. And there are many, many artists that I work with who have given me very similar feelings. Basha Chakrabarty is an artist who I love working with. And when I encountered her work for the first time in Los Angeles, I was so struck by the academic and scholarly rigor she brought to the work, while also having this incredible sense of aesthetic groundedness and heart to the work as well. I left and I was just blown away by the number of ideas and the synthesis of scholarship she was able to bring into it. But I also was so struck by her construction of figures, by her actual methods of making. She was using, you know, used clothing and indigo dye and all these different materials that were reimagined in such a powerful way. And so anytime I feel that intersection of head and heart and spirit, I know I'm onto something special.
Yes, and you spoke about scholarship there. And of course, there are so many great writers from the region and the diaspora. Mm-hmm. I wonder, are you engaging them in writing catalogs or, you know, doing a little bit of that intellectual excavation that you discussed?
I really hope to. We haven't yet so far. I've been the sort of driving curatorial force up till this moment, but this is exactly something I want to take on because literature really is my first cultural love. If not film, I think the awakening I had that led me on the path to this career really started in my teenage years when I started really reading very seriously. I will never forget the experience of reading Giambaleri for the first time and finding not only that she was depicting experiences that I found really accessible and familiar, but just aesthetically, the sparseness of her prose, the way that she took that experience of immigrant alienation and transformed it into an aesthetic. I feel there was like no looking back from that moment. I knew I needed to dedicate myself to the culture. And pretty much every step I've taken in my life and my career since then has really been towards hopefully where I am now and where I'm going, because I saw the power that great creativity can have to change lives. And I'm always thinking about that initial kind of engagement with literature. I was an English major in undergrad. I was really interested in not only Jhumpa's works, but also Salman Rushdie and Karen Desai. And I was really fascinated with how literature was consciousness expanding and also bridging cultures across the world. And I think that really was an important stepping stone towards coming to art.
Yeah, so many of those writers you mentioned, they really shape our thinking. And I think of, we mentioned Arundhati Roy, or, you know, they haven't shied away from saying harsh truths and illuminating. I mean, she's as much an activist scholar as she is a fiction writer, right? So, yeah, I mean, they're very powerful. So I look forward to more of that because I love those kind of dialogues. Me too. I'm a painter, but my first love, and I still do write, but my first love is writing. But it was all writers and filmmakers. Yeah. I didn't even think about inviting the artists first, even though I'm an artist. I just But yeah, so I think it all begins, you know, with story. I think that's the constant, right? Or with music too, which is even beyond words. But it's the most, you know, immediate thing and accessible thing if you're trying to explain, you know, the complexity of our inner lives. You know, I'm not going to paint a painting, you know, to talk about contemporary politics. You know, it's not as quick as to say, you know, what I'm thinking, what I'm experiencing in this moment. And so it's always important to honor that, though sometimes, you know, writers get like pushed off to the side, you know, fiction writers, the humanities in general, we see a kind of, I mean, it's sad to say, it doesn't get as many, you know, it's not Rage to Engage. And so I feel we have to do all we can to champion it, because I think, you know, particularly now, I mean, I'd like to know your views on, you know, AI and how that's changing us and the arts and how we communicate with each other and the stories we tell. I mean, is there a place for slow artists and writers and filmmakers? Because it's moving really fast.
I think there's absolutely a place for traditional forms of art making, and I think AI will only make them more rarefied and special. I think a lot about just the relationship between technology and creativity, and look to the fashion world. Mass manufacturing didn't eliminate the desire for couture fashion. It actually just made it more valuable, more special, more rarefied. I do think that we are going to live in a world with a lot of AI kind of slop, you know, filling our phones, filling our feeds. But I think the real life experience of seeing painting that comes from the human spirit and the human hand will retain its value, if not become more valuable in the wake of all that other work coming out. And I think the human ability to create is something we have to be socially invested in. I don't think this is about sticking our head in the sand and ignoring AI and pretending like it's not there. It is advancing. Technology advances through human history. That is part of the arc of humanity. I think it's important for us to celebrate the human in the wake of the non-human's rise. And so I will always stress the importance of coming in and seeing paintings in person, of celebrating the artists themselves and understanding their practice, because I think humanity is something very worthy of preservation and celebration. Increasingly, when people talk about AI in these very utopian terms, I find it a little bit scary to think that we can so quickly replace the human spirit. I don't want to deny it. I do think there are artists who are going to use it in very interesting and compelling ways, and it'll be their medium and their tool. And I'm very open to that, and I'm starting to see it already. But at the end of the day, I do want to put a stake in the ground for the importance of traditional forms of making, and I want to show how they're increasingly threatened.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, there'll be a lot of costs. There are already a lot of cost savings in terms of those blockbuster films that already maybe seemed synthetic to me. You know, in some ways, that's good. I mean, we have to protect our jobs. And obviously, you've seen that with the different strikes in LA from the entertainment industry. But the kind of human, two, three people talking in a room, I mean, why would you even do that in AI? You know, unless you were kind of like digging up an old actor or something. But you would just, it wouldn't even make sense, because it's just not going to move you. So I think that we really stake our claim to maybe the independent films and all these things that really is better done, you know, human to human, you know, as little artificiality as possible. So I'm not against the kind of, I can see that it can make sense, the cost savings. I've even seen some interesting things. I mean, they talk about fake news, but I've even seen some interesting sort of documentary visualizations of places that you can't go now. Like, say we can't go into Israel, Gaza. You're not, the journalists aren't allowed. So you put in the Dadi, put in some kind of reporters, and then this is what it kind of, here's an imagining, or this would just be, and they're really impressive kind of visualizations on the level. I saw like one, it was like on the level of like Spielberg one, like it was showing the situation in Iran at the moment. We have to make sure that we're not, you know, taking the AI for the real if it's not founded on fact. But I think that that can be helpful in terms of empathy building. But the other things, I think we do have to protect ourselves, because sadly this generation coming up, they may experience more of the fake before they get the real, and they'll just lose all sense of, they'll lose their bullshit detectors, you know?
Yeah, my biggest concern is what's going to happen to the audience itself, and will there be an audience that even wants humanistic expression? I think a lot about social media that came before AI and how it fundamentally did shift, especially generationally, the way people were experiencing things like fame and talent and visibility. And it did create a shift in terms of what, you know, audiences were looking for from pieces of art. People all of a sudden valued relatability above all else, because that was the aesthetic category that social media was pushing above all else. So all of a sudden you'll hear audiences respond negatively to film and literature, saying it wasn't relatable and I couldn't see myself in it, because that's how social media trained them to engage with content. And I think there might be a very similar kind of shift that happens with AI, where all of a sudden there's this expectation of on-demand or sort of consumer-driven perspectives, because I do think there will come a time where you can type in what movie you want to watch and the AI will generate it for you. I think we're definitely headed towards that track. And I think what I want to preserve is the notion that actually the artist's perspective is really fundamental, and you should engage and grapple with perspectives that are not like your own, that are not already within your consciousness, because that's how you expand your perspective. And so I think this is just sort of like a stake we have to make as AI rises, and we have to sort of name it and call it without, again, being afraid of AI itself.
Yeah, I didn't mean to go so far into it, but I think it's something that we have to. And one thing that is interesting, I have to say about it, is that I mean, you've seen the rise in the popularity of philosophers trying to understand this moment. Like, philosophers are often, they were being neglected. Now I see all these philosophers even, and neuroscientists, whatever, even being employed by these technology companies. I guess they have to, like, they have an ethics, I don't know if they get to make the decisions, right? But they're there as a sort of watchdog, whether they're effective or not. So that's interesting because when you're confronted with another being, another culture, all these things, you do ask then what's important to me? What is my perspective? Because this is obviously coming from someplace so different. And so I think it's good that we question what our values are, but I am concerned that in America they've pulled back on some of the legislation that Biden put in place, those guardrails and regulations that even they were not adequate in a way, but now I guess they've been repealed. So that's concerning to me.
Definitely. And I think this is going to require like really concerted attention and will. We have to want it. I think that's why it's so essential that we're highlighting artists and emphasizing the importance of the human, because the audience needs to want these protections in place.
Yeah. And I saw other things. I mean, under the Trump presidency, I actually didn't realize that he had withdrawn from UNESCO before, but then he repeated this. Now he's just done it again. So we see the rise of the importance of galleries, of private foundations, because these other government-funded projects just aren't there. NPR is no longer funded by the government. You know, these things, I thought they were sort of like guaranteed to have support because they're for the public good. It's dispiriting, but it also speaks to the importance of individuals and companies, and like yourself, doing the good work.
Yeah, I just want to share my passion for art, and if I can make that even a little bit contagious, I hope that we can build, audiences that really want to see this preserved and want to think about how they can contribute. I think one of the most exciting things about the gallery is we've gotten a lot of young folks involved in museum philanthropy and making donations to museums of artworks and thinking about what responsibility and agency they have in protecting and preserving culture. And that is very much part of the gallery mission and something that I hope to really promote and scale.
Yeah. And you were speaking about the spiritual dimension. You're talking about different places around South Asia. I mean, could you tell us a little bit, about your memories of the beauty and wonder of the natural world, through your travels or even in America? How is that landscape part of your practice?
For me, it is most clear in Kerala, where my family is from. Even just recently, it was just before the pandemic in 2020. I was in Kerala with some friends who had never been to India before, and I took them on a trip on the backwaters. And I myself was just struck by this sense of awe of the incredible landscape, but also knowing my own connection to it, that this is where my family was from. This is where all my ancestors were. This was our place. And feeling this really deep sense of like not only wonder, but connection to that wonder. Kerala is such an important place to me and my family. I think part of why I wanted to do the exhibition on Kerala and bring Kerala to LA in this specific way is I think I was very conscious of the loss that my parents experienced leaving Kerala and moving to the US because they had such a close attachment to this place. My dad's family was in the shipping industry for generations, and there was this strong connection to the sea and sort of Kerala as this point of connection to the wider world. My mom's side of the family were civil servants and felt very invested in the preservation and protection of the state. And so through all of that, I think it was just absolutely encapsulated by that experience of the backwaters, which I know often gets treated as this purely touristic experience, but one that I think is so emblematic of the natural beauty of Kerala and also just the magic of the place. When you're traveling on the backwaters, you also see this incredible sense of humanity. You see this incredible sense of coexistence between Hinduism and Christianity and Islam that's so unique in Kerala. You see the kind of political revolutionaries that have shaped the landscape through the types of sloganeering throughout the state. It's not only a glimpse of an unbelievable landscape, but also a beautiful, vibrant tapestry of humanity. And I think I carry that with me all the time.
Yeah, that's a really strong message for hope. And I think that that's what the arts can do. I mean, we also touched upon we're living definitely in interesting times. Everything's moving so quickly. So as you think about the future, maybe some of those life lessons that were passed on to you by important teachers or parents, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I want people to believe in the capacity for art to change lives. I don't want art to simply be something to consume or maybe to passively share online, but something to deeply grapple and engage with, knowing that art can completely shift the way you see the world. And I think that treating it both with that seriousness, but also, again, thinking about ways to make it more accessible is such a big part of my mission, because I do want to believe in a world where art is celebrated by a wide audience. I want to believe in a world where the artists I work with could become household names, that they could have that kind of impact on the culture that people know them widely. That is true of some select artists, and I want to make that even more possible. It's a utopian dream, but it's one that I want to still work towards nonetheless, with the belief that it could be possible, because I do see the artists I work with as culture changers, and I just want to spread that message.
Well, thank you for your sincerity and passion. We believe that strongly, that art can change the world, can shift perspectives, can open our minds. So thank you, Rajiv Menon, for sharing your vision and creating a unique space in the contemporary art world, which honors artists past and present and their unique contributions to art and society and increasing understanding and connection in a divided world. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much for having me. I love this conversation.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. The associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Jamie Lammers. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk with additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions or our podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram @Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thank you for listening.